I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture with me, Padraig Reedy. This week, Henry MacDonald on his new book, Two Souls. Henry MacDonald, welcome to Little Atoms, where we talk about Two Souls, which is your second novel, your first based in Belfast, and the Belfast that you grew up in.
This one is based in Belfast. This is about, it's based in the area I grew up in, the market area of central Belfast. It's a lot to do with the city centre, the punk haunts of the 70s, like the Pound and the Harp, even a subway where we all drank and sang and played music and graffiti the walls, and also a football stadium. It's divided into three sections, okay, in terms of times. There's a Summer of Love in 1978, where the main character, Robbie Ruin, who's the narrator, he's actually reflecting back on it. It's written in the past tense, with an older arty bohemian girl. Sounds like a line from a micro Disney song. You know? And then it flashes forward in beats of three to April 1979, specifically the weekend of the Irish Cup final. The young punk is now morphing into a soccer hooligan, and it's Cliftonville versus Portadown. Cliftonville now mainly supported by working class Catholics in Belfast, and the Portadown having lots of loyalist support. So combustible, you can imagine. And then it flashes forward again to 1987, and these very clipped, oddly written, lead on the line, smuggled communications from Belfast Crumlin Road Jail. And they're the prelude to a factional feud, which will suck in the three main characters of the book, especially the main character and the narrator. And there's almost like an Iago tone to the guy writing the letters to the other character on the outside, you know, whispering in his ear, playing whispering games, sinister allusions to get him to kill someone else, or at least to order the assassination of someone else.
And it builds to that quite shocking crescendo quite quickly. So tell us about your you say it's a semi, quasi autobiographical book. Tell us about the main character.
The main character is called Robbie McManus, or Robbie Ruin, his punk name, because punks have all these weird names, nicknames in Belfast, not anywhere ubiquitous. But he is the character that I think I could have become had I taken the wrong road. He's the character that some of my friends became by taking the wrong road. You're presented with a choice, and you're at a juncture in your life, and really it's you're moving from kind of testosterone youth violence into paramilitary violence. And there was an easy, you could see that easy bridge, that easy journey through that to the dark side. So that's what he becomes.
We'll talk a little bit about the book, as you say, starts in 78 in the punk scene in Belfast. Now, punk meant something specific and different, I think, in Belfast and to a lesser extent in Derry than it did to the rest of the UK. Can you talk about that a bit?
Joe Strummer, famously of The Clash, once said, New York had the bands, London had the clothes, but Belfast had the reason. And what he meant by that was that specifically punk emerged after the wilderness years of the early 70s, music bands didn't come, the hippie dream was dead, you know, glam rock was a joke. And then you had this movement, and in Belfast, it spontaneously, organically brought together Catholic and Protestant youth, right? All sides, very, very quickly, and everybody got to know each other, and there was a kind of a unspoken anti-sectarian code. It wasn't party political, it wasn't programmatic, it just happened. And that was what was unique about it. And in many ways, this book is called Two Souls because it's a quote from Goethe about two souls reside in my breast and each will fight for the mastery there. In the character of Robbie Ruin, there are two souls residing in his breast. One is the progressive punk anti-sectarian side of things, also coupled with his father's socialism, old-fashioned socialism. And then there's the other side, the magnetic pull towards getting involved in sectarian based kind of soccer violence, and then ultimately evolving into Republican paramilitary violent activity. So they were tearing at him, and what I suppose disturbed his inner being is the third element of the book, the 1978, is the end of the romantic dream, his first love.
Yeah.
And he turns to bitterness. A lot of young men do that, you know, they when they get crushed in an early love or a relationship breaks down, they fall into bad company. They can hit the drink, they can hit the drugs. I think lots of my friends went through that. Or they get involved in bad company.
Yeah.
And Robbie does.
Yeah.
And the bad company leads him to a kind of a violent, vacuous future.
I think that there's a lot of things that represent that, the escape from the maybe inevitability. And some of them, you know, coming from very different places, there's... I think we'll talk about Berlin's role in a little bit. But first of all, there is the girl he does fall in love with, the slightly older art school girl he does fall in love with, called Sabine, who's a very different person to what he's used to.
She is like someone from another planet. In many ways, I mean, the chapters with Sabine, the 78 love affair in the Holy Lands in Belfast, which was kind of a shabby, rundown, but very bohemian, arty, university-type area. It isn't so much now, but it was then. You know, you had lecturers and teachers and trade unionists and socialists living in that area because it was one of the few areas that was mixed religiously, you know.
Yeah.
And on top of... She was as exotic as the soundtrack of their love. The soundtrack of their love is the first Bowie album, Low, in his Berlin period, right? My opinion is best work, right? And they listen to Low constantly. She gets him into it.
Yeah.
And in many ways, Sabine's a wee bit like Boy. She's not of this world completely, you know. And she's as exotic as Boy is, in drab grey, you know, war-torn Belfast.
Yeah.
You know, she's this figure from another place. Life is elsewhere.
So Low is, you know, a personal favourite of yours. Not what one would take of as a punk record.
It is not, yeah. not by any means, but I had a kind of mixed kind of musical evolution. I mean, my older cousins were one of them was in the Bowie a lot and played it on a Saturday Sunday morning before we went to mass. Can you imagine that? You know, you're listening to David Bowie talking about Iggy Pop wrecking his house in Berlin, and then you're around, you know, the Gospel According to Mark and getting your Holy Communion. I've always liked electronic based orchestral kind of. I love the German electronic scene, Dinoy and people like that, and Kraftwerk, and, you know, so, and the post-punk bands like Cabaret Voltaire and that as well, and Certain Ratio and all that. So, yeah, I wasn't one of these 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 three chord fundamentalists, as I call them, you know. But it's not just the exoticism of Bowie and Sabine. The music is also very mournful, and although some of it's upbeat, the soundtrack, I hope readers will decide this, reflects what's going on in Robbie's brain and the pictures he's playing, you know. And it is a very mournful, you know, think of Warsaw, and Subterraneans in particular. And Subterraneans, of course, is the last track in the book. The last track.
Yeah.
It's the soundtrack of the last chapter.
So just following that, the Berlin album's obviously being, you know, very important to you. But there's Berlin... pops up in the books in a few different ways. There's through Bowie, obviously, turns up later in the book that, you know, someone's going to live there. But it also turns up as a kind of subconsciously, but alluded to in the character of the father, who is, you know, thinking of things on the other side of other side of the Berlin Wall, in a yeah. Yeah, in a position I think that in a lot of ways is probably he's already cast even in the late 70s as being a nostalgist, and there's nothing more to to his politics of being a dyed-in-the-wool communist.
The father's a dyed-in-the-wool communist, but even by then, the communists have been left behind. I mean, the war, the troubles, the conflict, call it whatever the hell you want, has rendered that section of the left. There was a strong communist element in the trade union movement in Belfast. Yeah. I mean, for its size, it was over-influential, but it still was influential. But even like things like the old Northern Ireland Labour Party was much more social democratic, mainstream party. Yeah. They're obliterated by the troubles, and a lot of Protestant working class socialists are either alienated or terrified out of public life, and rendered irrelevant. And it's the irrelevancy of Robbie's dad that I was trying to get across. At heart, he's a decent man, but he's irrelevant in two ways. A, by the troubles on his own doorstep, the workers aren't going to unite, right? They're too busy shooting each other, right? And also, the new Cold War is coming, and even then in 79, it's becoming obvious that the Soviet project is on its way out. I think, looking back, and when you're playing with a novel here, you're playing with history and time. So I think I did mention things like Ayatollah Khomeini, the Iranian Revolution. People are turning to they're not turning towards the left. They're regressing in time. In parts of the world, and also he's hopelessly out of touch with what's really going on behind the Berlin Wall, So I'm still a sympathetic man.
I think that fascinating picture of someone who genuinely, and it's something that we kind of don't think. I suppose it recurs a small bit now when we think about people getting their news from Russia Today or Press TV or someone who's fully bought into listening to Radio Moscow and getting reports from
Angola
and Cuba and so on. It's an entire life for him. You describe how his entire day is soundtracked. From waking up to orchestral pieces in the morning to the news in the evening. It's all there and laid out. An entire worldview laid out for you, which I guess says nothing about. None of it at any point says anything about Belfast.
No, it doesn't. That's right, because he thinks he's part of a bigger thing.
Yeah.
A bigger, more powerful thing, right? Mm-hmm. But in fact, he's not.
Yeah.
But I still wanted his common decency to shine out, to shine through. So yes, I mean, I am harsh on him, but I'm also sympathetic. Yeah.
And he regularly advises his son to just get the hell out.
Oh, he's not telling his son to join the revolution. Yeah. He's telling his son to get the fuck out, to get out of Northern Ireland, to get out of Belfast, build a life, even if it is in capitalist Babylon like London or somewhere. He just wants him out. Because he knows, he looks at the boys around him who are all joining up on the various armies and factions and alphabet soup groups, and they're all ending up either in prison or they're dead, within a matter of years. And of course, all that happened more or less, and I saw it happening,
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Patrick Reedy, and I'm talking to Henry MacDonald about his new novel, Two Souls. So, Henry mentioned the first of the kind of descent, I guess, from the the almost the quite optimistic summer of romance in 1978 at the beginning of the book, where your main character Robbie, you know, falls in love, you know, goes to gigs, you know, everything's, you know, it's everything you want when you're what, 16, 17. It's perfect. But he, this next stage of the book is 1979, it's the Irish Cup final, and there he joins his cousin Rex, who is born in Belfast but raised, you know, in Brighton, has come back with an English accent, with some very English attitudes in some ways to things like what you wear and what, how you act on the terraces and so on. And his friend, for want of a better phrase, Padre Pio, some, you know, one of these friends, you know, I think we've all had, who you can't quite shake off. Yeah. And the slightly older Trout, who is, you know, from a hardline Republican family, I guess.
Yeah.
And over the course of that cup final, we see how things shift for Robbie between personal issues with his cousin, personal relationships with Padre Pio, but also how the sectarianism becomes more and more important part of his identity over the course of one afternoon. It's very beautifully put together.
Yeah, I mean, there's a wee bit of it before. There's a precursor, you know, the start of the season and that, you know, and there's the scene in the bus where they're attacked in Loyalist East Belfast, which actually did happen to me. I was on that bus, and a character partly based on Padre Pio, did do that. He did wave the scarf at a gang of loyalists out drinking outside a pub, and we were ambushed, and they nearly got us off the bus. If they got us off the bus, we'd have been murdered.
Yeah.
I'm absolutely convinced of that. And a very famous guy in Belfast called Frankie Kim Quinn, a photographer, award-winning photographer, was on the bus. He got knocked out. We had to take him to Dundonald Area Hospital. Actually, we just dumped him, actually. We dumped him in A&E and went to the match in the North. And he still speaks to me, you know. We actually sit together at Clivenville matches now. The now old veterans of the game, but of the team and the club. But you're right. It's a good word, that bridge. I mean, the kind of building violence of the cup final and the anticipation of it, and the aftermath, and the kind of, it's like a force or a momentum that Robbie is carried along in.
Yeah.
He's put himself in this kind of sinister slipstream.
Yeah.
And he knows where it's going, you know? The chapter when I was opening up, we are in a trance. We are a moving, menacing organism. Those are lines, I think, from the opening, one of the early chapters of the cup final section. I wanted to get that idea of this kind of, almost like a kind of an army, like a phalanx.
Yeah.
Going, marching together, you know? Which was all the rage in the 70s. I mean, hooligans were like the ragged armies, you know, and that's what this was about. And it does then make the militant game.
Yeah.
The Belfast were, you have to be game.
Yeah.
Right? And they prove themselves. And of course, Trout's the talent spotter. But the next group of soldiers he has to recruit.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about Trout, about where he's coming from.
Well, Trout's brother is in jail for trying to kill a policeman. Trout's a member of a kind of Republican offshoot faction modelled on the Irish National Liberation Army.
Yeah.
A very extreme group that was prone to internal feuds. Every political differences is settled by the barrel of a gun, and resulting in ultra-left groups in Britain argue by waving papers at each other outside tube stations, right?
Yeah.
The ultra-left Republicans did it with lead bullets, you know, right? So he is always influenced, and he's always speaking. He's almost speaking as if he's making a speech. You know, ask yourself this. He keeps saying, ask yourself this all the time.
Yeah.
He's setting these wee scenarios up, and you know, his language is persuasive. And Trout is trying to entice them into the organization.
Yeah.
And other things in the longer run, too.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, he's. He's a pretty fanatical character. He's the ideologue. Yeah. The others join up for different reasons.
Exactly. So either side of
he's the ideologue
of Robbie, you've got this ideologue stroke demagogue.
Yes.
And you've got the other thing, which is crucial to any paramilitary organization, which is the psychopath.
Yes. Yes. And Padre Pio is a psycho. You know, he's a psycho. But the ultimate proof to be game.
Yeah.
He can riot against the prods.
Yeah.
He can pretend to be a Linfield supporter and infiltrate their support, which is what he did.
Yeah.
And he actually did that in real life, right? But the ultimate game is to pull the trigger.
Yeah.
And to join up and be willing to take life.
Mm-hmm.
And he's willing to do it. you know. And that's, Robbie's in the middle somewhere. Robbie has been propelled forward by personal bitterness and letdown.
Yeah.
And he's found comfort in the solidarity of male bonding. But the bonding is laced with undertones of violence. Yeah.
I think that's probably a thing we talk about an awful lot these days when we talk about young men, and I'm probably quite rightly talk about young men, is personal bitterness, personal anger at real and perceived problems in the world. And I think often when people, you know, people in the, particularly in the left in 1890 in Britain looked at Belfast and looked at what was happening, and the IR, and yeah, certainly the Republican movement were very good at this. We're very good at talking about this as a very noble political struggle carried out by high-minded, educated people with a greater aim. But every one of these movements does need, you know, which when it needs people with personal grievances, personal bitternesses, and anger driving them.
Absolutely, and Padre Pio, even though he is downright bloody evil, right? He has a backstory, which I reveal, I hope, subtly and layer by layer. And there's a reason why he's off the rails, right? And it's nothing to do with politics; it's personal, right? Very, very personal, right? And that, I've seen that. You know, I have seen the guys, yes, the grammar school boys, educated, who join up for ideological reasons. But I've also seen boys who join up because they want to be game.
Yeah,
they want to be gamesters. They want to be in the, being known as being in the army, being big raw men, or UDA men, and they want to be respected. And they want to get their rage out, right? They want to get their rage out on the world. And that's what Padre Pio is. He's the latter.
I think it's worth briefly talking about the, you touched on the INLA, and they are, you know, they are clearly the model for the organisation in this book, the model for both the language and the violence and the, and obviously you've literally written the book on the INLA. I suppose now we don't really think about them very much, but they were this, as you say, incredibly violent group, which had come from originally, I'll let you describe the origin story of the INLA, so to speak.
The INLA was an offshoot of the official IRA. So the official IRA becomes Marxist after the split with the Provost. And very early on in the Troubles, by 72, their leadership realised this is going nowhere, this is going to end in civil war. We've got to end this now.
Yep.
And try to negotiate with the Protestants, basically in the northeast of Ireland, to have some sort of settlement. Otherwise, the whole island's going to go on fire. And I think we're basically right when they said that. I think their analysis was correct. But there was a wing on a more ultra-left stroke nationalist grouping around a guy called Seamus Costello, who broke away. He didn't agree with the ceasefire. Now, they became allied with ultra-left elements, far-left elements, whether it was People's Democracy for a while, the Provosts were helping them, and they broke away to form a new army called the Irish National Liberation Army. So, and they became, as terrorist groups go, they became quite efficient. So now their apogee is the killing of Éirí Ní, Margaret Thatcher's advisor, an escapee from Colditz during the Second World War. They kill him in the House of Commons in 1979. They're catapulted into international fame. Trouble is, from their viewpoint, they were a kind of weird mixture of, they were a bit like the Badr-Meinhof Red Army faction in West Germany, but because they adopted all the kind of the lingo of the terrorist new left that emerged from 68, fighting imperialism on the streets, not just in the paddy fields of Vietnam or the deserts of the Middle East or whatever, you know. More, you know, I suppose they were more Trotskyist than Maoist.
Yeah.
Extreme Trotskyist. And a lot of Trotskyist groups in Britain aligned themselves with the INLA. They were the new messiahs, you know, the new deliverers of the revolution, you know. But they also had their cadres, their membership was primarily working class, and it's two front spearhead groups were Belfast and Derry. But Belfast was always the most important place to wage war, you know. And they were, you know, so you had that fusion of a couple of intellectuals and, you know, pseudo-intellectuals and old Republicans as well that didn't agree with the officials and wanted to break away but still were leftist in their mentalities, couldn't join the Provosts, right? And this group had an instability, just the way that ultra-left groups in Britain have a kind of a replicating instability and tendency to schism and divide. This organisation divided. And, I mean, their first feud was like, they had a feud with the officials in 75, right?
Yeah.
But they had a feud with themselves, and the first one was about 1980. 81, and they kind of were born out of a feud, and they would die in a feud, because factionalism was in the DNA, right? Does that make sense? And I wanted that in this book as well.
Yeah,
fratricide.
Yeah,
is another theme.
Yeah,
in the book, and it's one of the tragedies of Ireland. You know, modern Ireland in the 20th century, and well, not so much the 21st, but we still get a bit of it. But who knows? Who knows?
Right. But say it's very hard to describe how the progression down of the story without giving away too much at the very end. Yeah, but we do end up in a horrendous inevitability of the path that has been taken by a lot of these people.
I hope to, Paddy, I want to say something.
No, go ahead.
That in the portrayal of the characters towards the end, when they come out of the wash, and we're in the ceasefire period, the peace process. I do want to say, I hope I portrayed them as, some of them anyway, as damaged goods. I mean, a lot of them are damaged individuals, and in real life, I know a lot of them. And there's a lot of psychological soul searching, personal loss, regret, And I saw an astonishing piece of film on BBC Spotlight Northern Ireland.
Yes.
Recently, where an ex-IRA bomber, who I know, he breaks down on camera and says, "What was it all for?" And he cries.
Yeah.
Tears. And I think that was genuine.
Mm.
Because I know the guy.
Absolutely.
And I think that image alone for me sums it all up.
Yeah.
Futility. And that's another thing.
I think that's someone asked me this morning when I said we were doing this interview, how would I describe the book? And I thought, and I said, not a thriller. And I guess it's also more of a tragedy.
Yeah.
Fundamentally.
It's not a thriller. No. But I think that's fair enough. Tragedy. Mm. Oh, it does have a lot of humour in it, I hope.
Yes. Yes.
Right. And some people, Robert McLean Wilson, the Paris-based Belfast writer, he said it was scabrously funny. So,
I'll just ask quickly again, because this is the second of your books that of your novels that heavily references Berlin, and we'll just leave it at that. But why is Berlin important to you?
I used to live there. I was in East Berlin in 1981.
Mm-hmm.
I was in West Berlin in 85. I was in a squat, a punk squat. I had friends there, long term friends. I still go there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in the context of 78 and right through to 79, it's a life as elsewhere kind of fantasy acolyte place, especially West Berlin.
Yeah.
It's at the edge of something. It's the kind of quality you're probably seeing in Hong Kong now, but although that's getting spiraling out of control, but it's in a kind of a strange zone.
Mm.
And a lot of punks were actually attracted to go there too. It was a big squatter movement, and a lot of anarchists and punks I knew went there and stuff.
Yeah.
But it's a kind of a exotic attraction, but it's also a wee bit like Belfast. It had a wall through it. We've got 59 walls now, most of them built since the peace process. there was always a connection for me with the wall and our walls and barriers and zones.
Yeah,
that Soviet zone, French zone. I remember as a kid, looking at maps of newspapers like The Observer and The Sunday Times, where they would zone out Belfast and the orange and green patches. And then when you got older, you were passing by those areas, there was a lot of frisson of danger, even walking to school, that kind of thing. So maybe that's why the Berlin thing put the hook in me. But it's a kind of strange, even though it was a citadel and it was entrapped in an island of the German Democratic Republic, it was still somewhere that both Robbie and Sabine saw as a place of escape.
Mm-hmm.
So
Henry, would you like to read an extract for us?
The crowd, the 28th of April, 1979. We are not walking, we are surging all the way down the Donegal Road. We are a throbbing mass of primary colours, all red, yellow and blue. We are a moving, menacing organism through which courses currents of fear and expectation. We are a jagged, forward-marching phalanx of uniforms, from army surplus, denim skinners, snorkels, duffels, plastic, wool, leather, studs and spikes. We slide, stumble and trip over half bottles of scotch, scrunched up beer tins, broken glass and even splashes of carrot-flecked boke. We spearhead onwards to the swing gate of battleship grey and bottle green, to where the barriers of peelers and Brits will eventually part open, ushering us across the motorway and into the empty brick-studded fields behind Windsor Park. We are in a trance. I'm still on our side of the M1 and Trout is crushed up against my shoulder. We're hemmed in by a line of heavier older men in their 20s, all of whom he seems to know. They swell and bulge out of Wrangler jackets and blue parkas, and sport beards they shouldn't have bothered sprouting until well into middle age. They are comrading this and macaring that to each other en route, talking in the Belfast code called Braille about jobs, gear, napperings, smoky joes and up and unders. The last one provokes trout the crowd. Urie's here, Urie's there, Urie's every fucking where. Na 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 na. The Brits patrolling close to the run-down redundant football stadium glare at us when they hear this particular chant. And one of them, from the back of a jeep, sweeps his SLR rifle with a black rubber gun sight across our line, as if he's going to take us out, as if we really think he's going to open fire. Who's that lying on the dashboard? Who's that spattered on the wheel? Trout howls, as two-fingered salutes are offered to the Brit patrol. He then pokes me in the shoulder and points up to the side of the decaying old touchline stand, with the letters Celtic Park still painted over the giant green background. Look at that crowd, son, and ask yourself why. This is what this is about today, Robbie Ruin. They literally kicked and booted Belfast Celtic out of the league all them years ago to put the uppity Tig team in their place, which was off the pitch and out of the league for good. They made sure that that place over there was only good enough to run greyhounds around the track beyond the grass. But now we're back, and we're on our way to Windsor to fuck them all over, Trout says.
I've been talking to Henry MacDonald about Two Souls, which is out now from Merrion Press. This episode of Little Atoms was presented by me, Padraig Reedy, and edited by Sky Redman. Little Atoms is supported by 89 Up and hosted by Acast. If you enjoyed the show, please do subscribe and rate us on iTunes, and even tell a friend. And remember to check out littleatoms.com for a full archive. Thank you for listening.